Hello, my name is Tim, and Tim is an alcoholic.
Hi, Tim.
And I want to thank Bill for being my speaker buddy. We've been doing some email communication, and it's kind of a trip because he types one thing or two, obviously. I mean that in good nature because so do I, but I'm pretty damn good at it, to be honest with you. I want to thank the committee for even asking me to come down and do this because it's an honor to stand in front of you today and be asked to speak at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's neat to get to know Bill a little bit. You know, my wife, Tammy, I got married to a gal in this program, and she's really disappointed. I mean, really disappointed that she's not here this morning. I woke up this morning and thought maybe I had a relapse. I looked over, and I seen my buddy Butch laying in the bed next to me. I thought, holy Christ, what have I done? I told you I'd get you back. And in the back row back there, there's a couple guys, you know, in the back row, the half-measure section. Pat, pay attention. I was sitting back there during the raffle. There's a buddy of mine. I haven't seen him in a long time. The other day I was rifling through some cards, and here's Pat's number, and he was a friend of mine in Medford when I lived down there. I was wondering whatever happened to him last. I heard he was in Phoenix, and we're sitting down there at dinner, and he comes walking by. I said, hey, Brookings, go figure. And I said, who's speaking? He goes, I don't know, some guy. He says, you any good? And this is cool. It really is. It's just... it's a real treat for me to come down and, like, here at the meeting last night. I'm sitting in that room, and I look around, and I'm seeing people that are my teachers. Now, I'm standing in front of you today because of some really, really strong sponsorship that came out of Medford. I was 2 years sober. I ended up moving down to Medford and hooking up with a gentleman named Don Pila, and a lot of you guys knew Don. And when I hooked up with him, he told me, he said, the first night I met him was a Saturday. And I said, you know, old man, I said, where you go, I go. And who you know, I'm going to meet him. I did. And he says, good. And you pick me up tomorrow night because you're driving to Rogue River. And I look over and here last night, there's Lauren from Rogue River. And there's Jim Ward. And there's just a bunch of you guys in here. You know, and that was an old-timers meeting, man. You walk in and 30 years was new. It was. Eddie Hawthorne with 48 years. And, you know, and then Sis had him by, what, Eddie had Sis by 2 months. And they're always kind of, I mean, they died with 49 years sobriety. You know, and that was the kind of meetings I was going to, and thank God, it's just really neat to sit in here tonight. You know, if you're new, I got to make a comment to the man with one day. Okay, we can't guarantee you'll never take another drink, but now that you stood up in this room and we gave you a copy of this book, I guarantee you personally, you ain't never going to enjoy another one. Oh yeah. You know, somebody asked me earlier how I was doing. I said, I'm doing pretty damn good. Sober, fully clothed, in my right mind. Matching pair of socks, clean under on, right side out. That's spiritual. Got a couple of bucks in my pocket. Got a legal driver's license and a fully insured vehicle that's paid for. You know, I woke up this morning in a dry bed. You know, and if you're laughing at any of that, you're relating. You know, and it's all up, it's up, man. You know, and I want to thank Bill. You know, it's really a trip to be asked to come and do something like this because apparently he didn't know my story very well. Let me tell you about the first time I ever shared in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was court mandated AA. I didn't have a problem drinking. I did have a problem with cops. Kind of a common little problem a lot of us have. And so here I am. I'm court mandated to these rooms. I'm not real happy to be here. I'm not happy, joyous, and free. And I sit back there in the corner of the room and just radiate hate. And these guys, you know, you're doing your little AA thing, you're all smiling and hugging and doing that pukey stuff that you people do. And I'm sitting there minding my own business and just hating you as much as possible for quite some time. And one night there's this little dude up in Tualatin, up just south of Portland, a little guy named Byron, a little diminutive little fella. He's chairing a meeting one night and he points to the back of the room and I'm back there. See, the corner is safe. Can you relate to that? If I'm in the corner, I got the room covered. I got to keep an eye on you people. You know, I mean, it might rub off. And I'm sitting there in that corner, and I'm just kind of watching y'all. One night, Byron looked at me and goes, how about you? Would you like to share? What does share mean? I mean, think about it. I'm just crazy as hell, and I'm sitting in an AA meeting, and he asked me if I wanted to share. And that part of my problem was that I never did. And I looked at him, I thought, you know, who's he pointing at? I looked back and around, he's pointing at me. And I remember looking at this guy, I thought, you know, now what am I going to do? And there's this roaring in my ears. I feel my face flushing red, and I thought, you know, I need to do something now. And I kind of levitated up out of my throne of contempt and floated up the front of this room. And this is in front of about maybe 40, 50 people in a hospital cafeteria. And I walked up and I leaned over this guy's desk, and I don't know exactly what I said to him, but it was pretty threatening, and it was right to the point. You know these little AAers? This guy sitting with his hands folded, got that little spiritual look in his face. And he just kind of looked up at me with them little AA eyes. And I thought, this guy's either psycho or he's really not getting the picture. You know, and I just kind of upped the ante a little bit, and I said, if you think I'm kidding with you, Ace, I'll pull your ass out of that chair and I'll put you right through that window. And it didn't open. It's a plate glass window. And he still sat there with just that little look. And two guys across that room started scooting their chairs back from the tables. And they're over to my right side, and I saw that movement. And I look over, see what they're doing. I got to step over to the side, keep an eye on this dangerous little AA-er here. And these other two guys are making their move, and I told them, I said, "Kid, put your ass back in that chair. Don't clear them. If you do," I said, "you got window number two." And there was this third guy, this little goopy little monkey, been looking at me for a couple of weeks. You know the people that look at you like you're nuts? I didn't like him. He'd been looking at me like I was crazy. He was smiling at me. We were both sideways, and he knew, you know, we understand each other. And I told him, I said, "Before you go," he's a Native American. I told him I was going to scalp his ass before he got window number three. It's my story, and I'm sticking to it. So I'm single-handedly going to clean up Alcoholics Anonymous. Then I stop, and I kind of freeze frame, and I tell myself, "So, what are you doing? God, I'm standing in front of 50, 60 people going absolutely ballistic, threatening to throw people through windows and doing all this, going to scalp people." And I'm just, and I stopped and I said, "What? I can't even go to an AA meeting without weird stuff going on. I'm dry as a fire hazard." You know, and I thought, okay, disengage, go sit down. So I go back to my throne of contempt and I put my butt back in that chair. And the most critical thing is what that guy said to me, what Byron said. Something Don Peely used to say. You know, what that guy did, he shot me down with his next comment. Simple few words out of him, he torpedoed me, man. He shot me down. And if you're new in here, I hope that I shoot you down. That's what this is all about, man, is shooting people down. This guy, he looked at me, he said, "Thanks for sharing." Man, what do you do with that? I thought, I'll come back next week with a grenade and a couple guns and just start killing you people. And then window number two, this guy, he was sober 4 months. 4 months. And I looked at him, he was kind of a sideways character too, and I ain't believing this 4 months out of him. You people with multiple years, yeah, right. That 4 month guy, he's nuts. And he walks up to me and goes, "Man," he says, "that was great." He's just happy, joyous, and like he's found a fellow brother here. He walked up and he did what only you people in AA do. He walked up and he threw an arm around my shoulder. He's touching me. And he says, "Man," he goes, "that was just right on. That was so cool." He says, "Up to now," he says, "I've been the asshole in this group." Swear to God, true story. He says, "We just took a vote and you're the new one." He says, "Hey, you want to go to coffee?" And I don't know what to do. What is going to coffee? And all of a sudden, I just wanted to ride home, and I made a mistake, and I got in that guy's car. And a little Datsun B210, we drove across town to some pancake joint, and we used up all their sugar and coffee for the next 5 or 6 hours. And these guys are telling some crazy stories, and I have some of my own, and you're not going to beat me at that. So I threw a few stories back at them, and one of these guys, his name was Terry, had his crazy-ass story about stealing a helicopter in Vietnam and running out of gas. I like people like that. But I ain't never stole a helicopter. So I threw them a few of my lies, and they all kind of nodded, "Oh, yeah." And what I did, I made a real tactical error that night. And if you're new here, heads up. Paying attention, I hope. What I did, I let that guy give me a ride home, and you people found out where I live. And that was a tactical error as far as my drinking went. You know, I was 34 years old when I come to Alcoholics Anonymous. I went to the party when I was 14 and got here at 34, and a lot of weird things happened to me. You know, I don't know if I was born an alcoholic, My mother was full-blood Norwegian. My dad was full-blooded Irish. Maybe there's a little genetic predisposition. Yeah, if it wasn't for the Irish, you would get a whole lot of these meetings in a phone booth. I was baptized a Catholic. I was an altar boy. You probably sensed that. And you know what? I really did. I sang in the choir. Yeah, oh, so about me. We'll do that another night. Kind of nuts. You know, I remember, even as a kid, there was something about it. You give me a little bit of that wonderful stuff we call booze, man. We were in the sacristy one day. I was probably 11, 12 years old. And, you know, I'm a victim. It was always my older brother's fault. You know, it was his idea, and I followed along, and I get busted. We're in the sacristy, and, you know, any Catholics in the room, don't raise your hand, just blink. But, you know, them hosts are a little dry. And we've been fasting for like 17 days or something, and it's a little hungry, and he says, here, have a few. Man, that's a sin. He goes, just have a few. He's chomping a few. I thought, all right, give me a couple. Dry as hell, and he pulls his wine out, because I need something to drink, and he takes a pull off, and he goes, have a drink. I said, man, this is bad. We're going to go to hell twice over. What do you think you're doing? He hands me the bottle. I says, Carrie, this is not a good idea. I take the bottle, I put it back, the door opened up, and Father Gimple walked in the room. Mouthful of sacred hosts and the blood of Christ, and it's not my fault, man. Yeah, maybe I'm here in purgatory. I don't know. You know, I just, like I said, when I was 14 years old, that cork really kind of came out. We started stealing stuff and just doing what we do, and I got loaded, and I loved to drink. I loved to drink. You know, and I don't know about the day that I started drinking. I don't know if an alcoholic was born. I tend to think, personally, I really do, and there's some reasons for this, that I have a genetic predisposition in my family. Going back as far as we can see to the Middle Ages, we've been doing this stuff, you know. And I'm the only one that sobered up so far and stayed there, at least to this day, one day at a time. And I understand. I'm not going to go into all the war stories, but I do understand about the jails. My drinking took me places I didn't expect it to take me. I understand the knives. I understand the guns and the violence and the car crashes and the people getting killed. I understand all that because that's where this thing took me. You know, did that stop me? It did not stop me. I didn't have a problem drinking. I had a problem with circumstances. You know? And see what happened to me that night when I think I was busting on my fourth Dewey when I ended up in those meetings where I was threatening to throw those guys around and do all that kind of wild stuff. And what they did with me, they picked me up and they started taking me to different meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. I let them know where you guys found out where I lived. And these guys had come over to say, what are you doing Tuesday? Hell, I don't know what I'm doing. What day is Tuesday? You know, boom, they picked me up and they take me to all kinds of meetings. I had a real attitude problem. You know, I was carrying weapons into the rooms. I was trying to hurt people. I was constantly going off and kind of neat on a Saturday night when you hear the sirens and nobody cares. You know what I'm saying? A couple of new guys kind of looking around. But these guys took me to speaker meetings, step studies, took me to a gay meeting once. I said, what's with this? He said, we're going to teach you tolerance. You know, it's all kind of nuts. And, I tell you what, you know, I sat there and I was wild. It was my first year in Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't do it I didn't do it right. Hell no. But then a lot of us don't. I didn't get a sponsor. You guys, some of you needed sponsors. I don't. You know, what I need to do is just kind of sit here and chill out and we'll do it off the wall and some of it out of the book. A guy named Lloyd grabbed me one day up in Portland. He says, you know, there's a meeting across town that's been a real help to me. And I think that maybe you ought to come with me and just at least check it. And we're on the way down there and I'm asking more about this meeting and he ain't telling me much. And these other church meetings are just, I was in conflict with you guys all the time. I was just going ballistic and threatening to hurt people and all that good stuff. We walked into this little meeting hall down in Portland. Some of you know the place called Scully's. Yellow. We walk in there, and now this is the kind of meeting hall where these guys will read out of the book, they read a sentence, and they point at you. Don't give you a name, they just say, you. And they're expecting you to share in what they just read. And he read something, I don't know what it was. And he pointed at me. And I went off about that ex-wife, the ex-dog, and all this stuff. You know, I've been evicted, convicted, and divorced. And all of a sudden, that book came flying across the room. Not little underhand, little here, catch the book. It was like, and he says, page 25, you dumb son of a bitch. He's calling me names and he's throwing stuff at me. And in that book that you got today, page 25 is marked. Because you know what he said? He goes, page 25. And I sat down next to Lloyd and I'm thinking, I'm not happy with Lloyd for bringing me to a room of people like this. And I looked at Lloyd and I said, what's on page 25? And Lloyd leaned over and he said, why don't you read it? Oh, I threatened to throw Lloyd out of his own truck while he was driving it on the way home. True story. He had a three-legged dog. That's one of the things I liked about the guy. You know, page 25 says that there is a solution. You know, glasses. 47 years old now, I can't see. They told me if I kept it up, I'd go blind. I'm Catholic. I was willing to risk one eye. If you're laughing, you're relating. You know, on page 25, it says that there is a solution. Almost none of us like the self-searching, the leveling of our pride, the confessions of shortcomings which the process requires for its successful consummation. But we saw that it really worked in others, and we had come to believe in the hopelessness and the futility of life as we've been living it. When, therefore, we were approached by those in whom the problem had been solved, there was nothing left for us but to pick up the simple kit of spiritual tools laid at our feet. We have found much of heaven, and we have been rocketed into a fourth dimension of existence of which we had not even dreamed. Now, those words impressed me. I didn't understand them. I wasn't at that time capable of working the steps. I talked to Floyd or Lloyd about him sponsoring me, and he just cracked up. We're at a coffee one night. He goes, yeah, we were wondering when this is going to come up. We're all going to sponsor you. There were five guys. So I had a sponsored crew. You know, and that was all fine and well. I thought, yeah, some of you guys, you got one sponsor. I got five. I'm one-upping you. And I'm just ricocheting around AA for the first year. And I got to tell you this, because it's a little critical to my story. I mean, you guys work your program and I won't, right? So here I am. I'm the first year. I owe a lot of money. There's a lot of debt coming up. The wife's taken off. The dog's caught the attitude. Everybody's gone and stuck with a lot of bills. And I hadn't really come in here all the way. I had, but I hadn't let go of all them people I've been running with for years. Those are my bros, man. You guys are telling me I got to leave all that behind me. Now, if I do that, what are you going to give me in return? See, I hadn't seen that part yet. And it's that transition. You're telling me to trust this process, and that process is about God. And I'm not there yet. I couldn't quite make that transition. So I'm still at 1 foot back there in the old days. And so anyway, some product kind of popped up in my life. And I've been hanging out with a lot of these crazy people, and I knew damn well there was a market for automatic weapons and Alcoholics Anonymous. Still is. You know, so this is my little gun running in AA part. And when I went to these guys, my little sponsor committee and some of these people, and we're offering them some negotiated prices, one of them asked me, he says, can you get a break on quantity? I said, yes, I can. They went over to one of the little AA huddles, came back and said, you've been sober a year? Yeah. Fill this out, and I filled it out because my legal stuff up to that point was cleaned up. I was looking to ruin that record. And they said, get in the car. And we ended up going to the federal penitentiary down in Sheridan. I thought it was like an AA field trip. We're talking about this at dinner. My buddy Gus is sitting here. And his sponsor, anyway. I go in the federal penitentiary. We're in lockdown. These guys are criminals. They deserve to be here. And there's a bunch of them, and I'm glad for penitentiaries. Some of these guys really need to be locked up. And well, here's this one guy running around the room, and he's handing out these some kind of spiritual writing. I don't remember what it was, some kind of poem, just how grateful he was. He was happy, joyous, and a convict. So he needs to get a clue, and his name was Angel. Gus's sponsor. A lot of you guys know Angel out of Eugene. Well, here's Angel, man. This is when I first met him. And these guys have set me up. You guys are sneaky. See, I'm trying to sell a couple trunk loads of guns. And Angel, his story is a public knowledge. He was an arms trafficker. Big time. I'm a little punk trying to do a few trunk loads. It's not the same. All the way home, I'm not happy with these guys. They're trying to ruin. I got a little deal. I can make some fast cash, pay off some stuff. What? Get off my back. And they're referring to the people I just met. I'm going, no, man. Anyway, Alcoholics Anonymous, the first thing it really did beyond me quitting drinking was stopping my criminal activities. Shortly after the gun running portion, I had the opportunity, I'm sober about almost 2 years, Hadn't worked the steps. Things were settling out. I'm kind of set, you know what I mean? I'm doing the 1-2-3 number. I'm sitting in these rooms, and the opportunity came for me to move down to Medford. I took it. It's time to get the hell out of town. There was a guy in Portland, his name is Jack, lives in Eugene today. And Jack told me, he says, you need to look up a guy named Don Peeler. I don't like Jack anyway, so don't tell me what to do. He says, really, you ought to look this guy up. I think you'd really get along with him. Don't tell me what to do. Because Jack said, I just tune him out, you know, just 36 years old and I'm a moron. I get down to Medford, I ain't got no sponsor, I haven't worked the steps, I'm just kind of driving a fire hazard, I'm real dicey here. And we get down there and I hook up with these guys at the Medford, what is that, the Nightmare on Elm Street, the club down there. A couple people in here going, I hate that one. But good. The Nightmare on Elm Street, we hook up with some of them AAers, and there's a truck stop there that the meetings go to, Witham's truck stop. We go down to Witham's, and here's about maybe 8-10 people. And there's this one old guy with his Mexican cholo hat on and his cane, and you know, one of them old timers with a nicotine stained mustache and, you know, yellow zipper, rusty zipper and yellow tennis shoes. And Ashley, no tennis shoes, but we're down there and everybody's kind of shooting a breeze, and I'm sitting across from this guy, and my butt was halfway falling off that night, because really I put myself into a bad spot. And me and this guy were just talking, and he starts sharing with me, let me share with you what Father Barney shared with me. I heard it, Father Barney. And he's also talking about these other guys he's known through the years. He mentions this some guy named Chuck, how he run to what Chuck would share with me, let me share with you. We're just talking, and I'm getting this wisdom from this guy. He just totally enraptured me. And else, everybody else is gone. It's me and him, and his name was Don. This is the guy that Jack told me to look up, and I'm never going to look up because Jack told me to. And I said, you're him. He goes, who? I said, never mind, you're him. I said, that's when I told him. I said, where you go and who you go, or where you go and who you know, I'm meeting him. I'm with you, old man. From here on, I run with you. And that was the best damn thing that ever happened to me. Because, you know, he did. That's where I got to know some of these guys I started out with. And there's a lot more of them in this room. Jack and Virginia and Otto and Marianne. You know, God, I wish they were here. I mean, these guys are, I need to reconnect with a lot of you people from down south here. And you're going to be hearing more of me. Okay? And, you know, let me tell you. See, what happened with Don, number one, he sent me home. He made a comment about something in his book. I didn't pay attention to what page it was. He suggested I look something up and read a certain story, and I remember what it was. But here I'm at 4 o'clock in the morning, I can't find it. And I almost called it. Not a good move. And I finally found it on my own, and things began to happen with me. Now, a couple months later, because I hadn't worked these steps, I know I got to do it because I got stuff that's just boiling up inside of me. You know what I'm talking about? Where all that crap, it's overflowing. I haven't done anything with it. And I hooked up with Don one night. We're down at Witham's again. And I've been intellectualizing that fourth step. I'd done 1-2-3. And Don had a spiritual program that was so basic it was unreal. God's God and you ain't. Hello. He doesn't understand. I was an altar boy, man. We need to discuss this. And here we are down at Witham's one day. And I'm talking about getting into that fourth step and really doing it to it and taking that inventory. And all, you know, we'll do all the columns and all this good stuff. Now, one thing about Don is that he had a fourth grade education. He came out of Camarillo State Mental Hospital as a wet brain. Only one of two people I ever heard of that did that. Most people die that way. It would take Don 10 minutes to read a page or two in a book. His vocabulary was that of somebody with a fourth grade education. So, you know, and here I'm obviously an intellectual. And you guys can laugh at the right parts. But, you know, here we were. We're down there with them, and I'm telling them, I need to do this fourth step in the columns, and we're discussing the processes that I think really should be applied in this venture. And I'm in mid-sentence, and I'm really kind of really thinking this through, and I'm really kind of presenting something to the old man. And he gets up and walks off. You know, there's old-timers here who do that in mid-sentence. You got to just take a hike. And he just gets up and walks off. And I thought, you know, that's a hell of a note. Right when I'm right in the middle of something really transitional here. He walks up and he's shooting a breeze with his gal at the register. Comes walking back a couple minutes later and he reaches in his pocket, pulls out a book of matches. He always had a cigarette going. Here's the back of the matchbook off. pulls out a pencil, throws down the matchbook. He obviously needs a phone number. Takes the pencil, breaks it in half, puts the eraser back in his pocket. Throws down the pointer, and he goes, I want you to write down a couple of words. It's a matchbook. On the back of that matchbook are the three things you're going to take to the grave. I'll be back in 10 minutes. I'm going to have a smoke. What do you do, man? You know, he's coming back. There's one camel going to get smoked. He's coming back. I'm looking at that matchbook and this pencil with no eraser. And it's like, hello, the rubber hits the road. You know what I want to share with you now is what number two was on that list. In that little list on that matchbook. Because you see, the bottom line is that we're creatures of shame and secrecy, you know, and regret and all that crap that we carry around with us. I've been hiding this stuff forever. I mean, like every one of you in this room, if you didn't feel that way at some point, you wouldn't be here. You know, this isn't the PTA. You know, and I was sitting there, and what I did, I took that matchbook and item number two on there. I shared it with him, God, and I'm going to share it with you. You know, because item number two on that list, if anybody ever knew about this, what are you going to think of me? I can't share it openly in these rooms because if I do, you're going to think I've gone too far. And I'm too damaged and too broken and I don't belong here. If I share that with you, you're going to think that I'm too much, I'm subhuman. And I couldn't do that. So the old man put that matchbook down. And all I did, there was two windows, I wrote there, looted Wendell, two words. He says, tell me about this. And what I had done, it was about maybe 3.5-4 years before I got met Don. So it was a couple years before I got sober. There was a guy that I'd been running with quite a bit. You know, a lot of stuff going on in his life. Like, you know, we're attracted to like-minded people. Anyway, this guy had been recently divorced and evicted, convicted, divorced. And he's drinking like a pig and so am I. He didn't have a job. He's writing a lot of hot checks to keep the party going. And I'm encouraging that. Holidays come, and you know, that's a depressive time for a lot of people, particularly us. And all of a sudden, this guy blinks off the scope, and we can't find him. And it was suggested that maybe I could look out in the garage, I might find him out there. I had been out in the garage with him a couple of days before. He's out there feeling sorry for himself. He had a half rack of Budweiser, full carton of Marlboros, and he had a beer, I had a beer. I said, don't do anything stupid, Wendell. And I would just, you know, that was the limit of my empathy with him. 4 days later, I'm back in that garage. Here I find Wendell in the front seat of that car, face down. Keys on, battery's dead, gas tank's empty, and all the windows are closed. And I did. I reached over, checked him for a pulse, and he was cold as hell. And what I did, I pulled him up and kind of took a look. Oh, Jesus, Wendell's really dead. He's going to be dead for a long time. And I looked on the seat of that car, down the floorboard, and there's a half rack of Budweiser, missing two bottles. And you know what I did? I took that beer. See, he quit drinking, hadn't he? And I hadn't. And then up in the dashboard of that car, there's a carton of Marlboros. He apparently quit smoking at the exact same time he quit drinking. Of course, I took them cigarettes. I thought, now I wonder how much cash he's got on him. And I reached over and I pulled his wallet out, and there was about $17. I thought, where's the rest of the cash? And I took his corpse and I peeled him up on the side. And 4 days in cold weather, you're dry, you're like a board. And there's a condition, I don't know what you call it, but the blood pools up on the downside and it looks like you've been severely bruised and it ain't pretty. And I peeled him up and I went through his front pockets. I'm looking for the money. And I took the change. And when I reached in there, his bladder had voided when he died. And I got my fingers wet in his urine. And it didn't stop me from taking the change. What are you going to think of me if I tell you about that kind of stuff? What are you going to think about where I'd gone? Because you see, when I lit that party up at 14, I didn't expect to go to this place. This isn't where I was taught to go. My family never gave me that kind of instruction. I didn't come from that kind of environment. And here I am, and I know that there's something really twisted about doing that. And later that day, I'm sitting down, I got the county coroner across from me because I found the body, drinking a beer, smoking them smokes, got that wet, pissy money in my pocket. And I know that there's something really wrong, and I don't know how to straighten this thing out. See, I crossed that line. I didn't have it anymore. It had me. It had me. And I had no idea how to stop the crazy stuff going on in my life. I didn't know I was an alcoholic. I didn't know that this is alcoholism, in fact. I didn't connect all that. dryer and a fire hazard in this program. I didn't connect those dots. It wasn't until that old man put that matchbook down in front of me, had me write those three things down. And the reason he did that in the matchbook, because that cracked the dam and it broke everything loose. Everything after that was like a floodgate. And I don't have any secrets today. I don't have any secrets, man. You know, that was the big kahuna for me that really got things moving. And here we were hitting Rogue River, and these guys, I mean, there's teachers of mine here tonight. I haven't seen Lauren in a long time. I seen Jim the other day, and I walked about to kiss him on the back of that pretty head of his. You know, I love these guys because you guys are my teachers, man. I miss seeing them at Rogue River, and my buddy Pat back there, who's a certified maniac. I can take your inventory a little bit because I got the microphone. But you'll take mine later, you know. It's just, this isn't such a bad deal. You know, and from the time those guys started me going into like the nut wars and places like that, you know, it was for the penitentiaries. From there, what we did, we graduated into jails, psych wards, you know, all kinds of different places. They got me busy. You know, I was downstairs at the Alana Club in Portland, you know, the big mansion. I'm making the coffee, by God. And you know, and it's hard to get drunk when you walk around a meeting and you got a pitcher of decaf in one hand and a pitcher of regular in the other, and you're walking up to people you don't like in the first place going, coffee? And of course they go, yeah, but just a little bit. Pour them a little bit and they got a smile at them, even though you want to hit them with a pot. Yeah. And that's what I felt about it for a while. Then they smile back at you and say, thank you, and go, oh, man, thank you, you're welcome. And after a while I become a friend. But you know, I physically couldn't get drunk when I was holding them pitcher or a coffee pot in one hand or the other. You know, these guys made me a greeter for a while up at a meeting up in Portland. That was a trip. Then I ended up moving back up to Portland. And there's a meeting out. Where's David? Here you are, my man. It's cool. You know, I was sitting here the other day. We were talking about huge events, and I thought, yeah, and I didn't tell these people. I thought, I got a buddy of mine back in Minneapolis. He was standing out in front of the convention hall on this little bridge greeting everybody. How many hands did you shake? Thousands? I thought, I wonder where Dave is. I walked in here. Here's Dave. It's kind of neat to be a part of. But anyway, there's a meeting out in Lake Oswego. This little speaker meeting that I went to one night. Anyway, it's kind of gentrified and yuppified and all that good thing. These guys, what really did me in was that there was the sliced kiwi. Hello. Sliced kiwi. Let's have a snack. Some little gal sitting in the corner, some little woman still in her house coat and all disheveled and dirty, and she's still drunk and nobody was really talking. They're not just caught me in real attitude. And how do we start meetings? You get a resentment, right? Get a resentment, borrow a coffee pot, and get it on. Well, I caught me a resentment. I figured, you know what? We're going to start our own AA meeting. We're going to start a speaker meeting. Everybody says, you're crazy. There's already OBs and some other ones. Says, no, this is going to, we're going to do something cool. I don't know what the hell it's going to be. Anyway, we ended up calling it SSAL. Sit down. Shut up and listen. Still going on to this day. They raffle a toilet seat signed by the speaker. Got to admit, it's kind of catchy. You know, and it was all based on a resentment. And the thing was, here we are one night. I remember telling these guys sitting around Danny's apartment when we were first organizing this thing. I said, you know, somewhere in the future, we do this really right. We get a lot of people, a lot of service work. We really get some stuff going. We can really stir, you know what I mean? Just stir it up. Stirring it up is good. You know, we do it right. I mean, in years to come, we'll be able to sit in the back of that room. People have no idea who in the hell we are. And there'll be hundreds of people at this meeting. Well, about 2 months ago, I'm sitting in the back room. You know what? They had no idea who I am. That hurt my feelings a little bit. It's like, I started this. Who in the hell are you, you know? And I don't know why I shared all that. I just thought I would. Hey, you know, keep the faith. We'll be out of here by 10:30, 11 o'clock. We were talking about that earlier. You know, people go on for 90 minutes, 95, hour and a half, 2 hours. Give me a break. You know, another thing happened. I was talking to Francine about it this morning when she spoke. The last time I heard Francine, she was kind of an irritant to me. She was. She was the Sunday morning speaker about 5.5 years ago up in Seaside. Now, here I am at that convention. I'm sober. I'm not dead. and I'm single, and I can walk in for the breakfast, and you get this big plate of food, and you sit down in this big hall, and you know, some of you guys know that meeting, and sit down, eat breakfast, and have the speaker. And I walk up, and here's this table, and there's this good-looking little brunette next to this redhead. Hey, you ain't stupid, right? I sit down, good morning, how are you? And Natalie leans, well, hi, who are you? I'm Timmy. And all of a sudden, this redhead sat forward. She goes, hi, I'm Tammy. I said, whoa, Natalie, back off. And then Francine started talking. She was really disrupting me. This gal was from up by north of Seattle. I'm trying to talk to her with speakers running her mouth off, and I had things to do here. You know, and anyway, we kind of just kept yapping away. And, you know, I'm kind of a sly little drunk. And what I did, I gave her that gold chain. And here, hang on to this, and we'll hook up and have lunch at the space meeting. Not a bad idea. I had to do something, man. She's leaving town, and you know, we're going opposite directions. Anyway, that started a relationship that kind of went back and forth for like 5 years. And the long and the short of it is, here about a year and a half ago, we got married on the beach over in Kauai. Hey, it works, by God. You know, and I got to tell you something with that. Tepila told me, Don loved baseball. Loved baseball. And he told me one time, he says, you know, what you got to look out for, you know, where's your hand going to be when God throws you that home run pitch? What? He said, where's your hand going to be when the old man throws you that home run pitch? If you're over here grab-assing over in that direction, you're going to miss that ball. He's a wet brain. Sometimes he's like, what the hell are you talking about? I understand him today. It makes a little bit of sense. You know, because what happened, I kind of cooled my jets, and when that home run pitch came at me, I was kind of ready for it at the time. You know, and I had to be sober 7 years before that happened. I love that girl. I tell you one thing, I love her, and she really wants to be here, but it's kind of a good thing that she ain't, because she quit smoking yesterday. It's on the tape, honey. Yeah, cool. It's like, and she's a competitive trap shooter, so it's a good thing I'm here. Chick's bad with a 12-gauge, let me tell you. You know, but we're in the backyard a while back, and there's two crows sitting on this fence. They're over the garden. Go, get your gun. She goes, I can't, we're in the city. Get your gun. One round, two crows. I need to find the Native American that can translate this into me for two crow killer woman. I want to make her a t-shirt. But you know, these guys got me into all kinds of stuff. We started doing meetings. Pila got me into a meeting down in the Jackson County Jail. And then we were also taking panels up the Oregon State Penitentiary. And I don't know where I'm going with all this. We're just going to shoot from the hip, and I'll share it. One day with Don and a couple of the guys from Medford. I don't think any of those people are here today. But, Pat, were you in on that when we take them runs up to Salem? There was one in particular. Maybe you were there that day. It was because of the constraints of the penitentiary. There's no denim and all that stuff. You got to wear a baggy cotton, you know, pajamas and whatever. And I'm wearing sandals with no socks. We drive all the way from Medford to Salem with a cigarette break about every half hour. So it took us 2.5 days to get to Salem. And we get up there, and sure enough, they change the rules a little bit. This guy looked at me and says, no socks? You can't go in with no socks. It's a penitentiary, man. You know, he said, nope, they just changed the rules. They're right here. I said, what in the hell are you going to do on Sunday morning in Salem when you don't have a pair of socks? I can tell you right now, not much, because I tried. I did. I went zinging and zooming all around town trying to find some socks. It's been an hour and a half. I ain't finding any. Nobody's going to give them up. And I come back and I said, you guys got to go in. I'll just hang out here and find something to do just to kill some time, and I'll catch you when you come out this afternoon. The old man, he shakes his head. He says, man, that sucks. He goes, damn. He goes, you're willing to go on any length? I said, yeah, man. You know, come on. I'm trying. Don, there's nothing I can do. There's no way they're going to let me in here. What are you going to do? I said, I already told you, I'll just hang out here. You guys take your method inside, and I'll catch up with you later. We sat out there, and we had a smoke sitting on the steps right by the front gate. He's shaking his head, and he's totally setting me up. You old-timers. He says, you willing to go to any length? I said, how many? He always asked everything in triplicate. I said, yeah, sure. It's just the pat answer. And he goes, okay. And he reached down and starts pulling his shoes off. I said, what in the hell are you doing? He peels off this sweaty sock. He goes, I want to see this. Oh, man. You ever put on somebody else's cold, sweaty sock? Oh, yeah, now you're sobered up a little while and you're all getting kind of... Anyway, I put that sucker on, both of them, and we went inside. And the great part was that he had some kind of metal in his shoe, and they said, take off your shoes. No socks. Yeah, but he's an old-timer. He's been there forever. They let him go anyway. I said, that sucks. I'm, you know, but it... And we had a lot of fun. You know, I remember coming back with those guys, coming down I-5, and it's right by the Jefferson exit. Every time I'm on I-5, I come by this one area. I think for the rest of my life, I'll always think about the emotions I had in that van that day where there was five of us. We're coming down south, and I look around this van. Everybody's kind of tired. We've been up real early going up there to do this meeting. We're on our way home. You know, you have the meeting going too, and you have one coming back. And I look around this van at these guys that I've become my brothers with, a band of brothers. And I thought, man, this is the best damn deal I've ever had. It really is. You know, from where I came from, where nobody's asked me to keep coming back. You guys weren't walking up to me in the meetings and hugging me and telling me to keep coming back. And here I am with these guys, being able to do the kinds of things we're doing. And it was a hell of an experience. And it just saved my noodle. You know, and then from OSP, some other people got me into some of the psych wards, and we started doing the treatment centers, you know, all the H&I stuff that so many of us do. The amount of time in this room today, if you're new, I can guarantee you, you bank on this. You talk to anybody here with these 33 years. I was sitting in the meeting last night, there were five of them in a row. It's like a conspiracy. You know, every one of them, you bank on it, have done all this kind of stuff. And if I want what they got, I go where they go. I do what they do, and I come to know who they know. So these guys put me in the car, and we started taking meetings down to the Oregon State Mental Hospital. Some of you guys have been there. And there's a ward in there for the adolescents, ward 40B. Okay? And 40B is the teenage adolescent ward. And the place broke my heart. We go in there, it's one ward over from where they filmed One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. This huge, echoey, dark hall. And the first night we went in there, as we walked in through these huge, massive oak doors, you could hear this screaming from down the hallway. Somewhere way far away, this is the screaming, now like in a bad movie. And we go back in, and you take a left in this one door, and here's about maybe 15 kids. And it was Christmas Eve, and they had these little twigs off these fir trees. And they made up their own little ornaments, little paper chains and stuff, just stuff the Christmas stuff as much as they could, bottles of Sprite and Coke. And we're doing an AA meeting that night. And we did like the old man and the rest of us, you know, in that panel, we shared a little bit. And then we went around that room. And everybody and anybody that wanted to share that night was welcome to. We ran a little long. There's this one girl sitting over in the corner. She's 17 years old. Her name was Amy. Amy piped up. See, I mean, there's a miracle in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, not everybody ever even sits in one of our rooms. If you didn't make it here, you've beaten the odds. If you hit one meeting, you've already beaten the odds, because most people never do. And Amy piped up, and she'd been sentenced there by her parents and some other stuff she'd been through. And she started sharing a little bit about her life. This girl had been doing things out behind them dumpsters and things in them alleys to get a drink that most adults never do. She'd been places and seen things that most people have no conception of. Her boyfriend had been gunned down a few weeks before in a drive-by, and her ass was falling off. And she shared from the heart about where she was coming from and maybe a little bit of hope. And what we did, we formed up in that circle like we're going to do here in a little bit. You know, and there's that prayer that we use, you know, to the Our Father. When we said that prayer, she's on my right-hand side. And Amy grabbed onto me. There was a guy, Ted Harbach, passed away a couple years ago. Ted used to talk about this, that if you can hold an alcoholic in your arms and let him cry, and really let everything break loose, if you can experience what it's like to do that, then you're going to capture the essence of what we have there. Amy grabbed onto me, and she started to cry. Not a few little snotty little tears, but a lifetime of hurt and shame and pain poured from this kid. And she was crying so hard, I couldn't understand what she was trying to tell me. I was wearing a black chamois shirt, and she ruined it. And finally, she was able to get it out. And Alcoholics Anonymous is about one drunken soul sharing their soul with another. Right? That's what the hell this is all about. And this kid is sharing this with me, and I'm going to share it with you. Because she told me, she says, maybe, just maybe, there is hope for a person like me. We all think we're different, man. We all think we've gone too far, done too much for too long to too many. I walked out of there that night, and for the first time, I walked out in them stairs, and it was raining. Get outside, fire up a smoke, raining, cold, nasty, and I just started bawling like a baby. That had never happened to me. And just, man, it blew me away. I'm going to roll the clock forward about, I think it was 3 years later. Some of you guys know Bill D. out of Chemist? Yeah, some of you got it. Anyway, here I am with Brother Bill. We used to go in and take these meetings into that psych ward. And here 3 years later, it's another Christmas, and I was over at my folks, he called me up, he needed some help to go in there, and we hooked up, and there was the panel that really winnowed down. And there was Bill and I, and he had a gal down in Corvallis that he was going to meet with. And she hooked up with us, and we all three go into that institution that night. And this night, the same thing, a couple little twigs, they're doing the best they can to make a little Christmas tree. And the group was only about maybe 8 or 10 of these kids. I shared that story. This girl that Bill had come with us, she was only in her maybe early 20s, and she looked over at me across the table, and her eyes got big, and her hand shot up to her mouth, and the tears started pouring down her face. And my buddy Bill reached up behind me, sitting behind me on the right side, reached up and tapped me on the shoulder and said, Merry Christmas. That's her. Yeah, I get goosebumps every time I tell that story. You know? And she's still sober today. She ended up kind of breaking out of the system. She lives up in the valley, got a couple of kids, and she's doing fine. I haven't seen her in years, but I talked to Bill, and he talks to her. And she's kind of like my little talisman. You know, and I love AA, man. I'd have missed that. You know, and like I said, I come from a family of Irish, on my dad's side, Norwegian on my mom's, for whatever the hell that's got to do with anything, but preference of liquor, I guess. But the Irish, we don't have one. But, yeah, wet. I'll take wet, please. And, you know, my mom loved the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. She did. You know, and she loved to go to the meetings. And she loved what had happened here. She came to know quite a few of the people in these rooms. You know, and I was at a meeting one time up in, you know, isn't this something? This is an AA meeting, right? And people get a little weird over like there's a drunk in the room. You ever heard that? There's a drunk in the meeting. What are we going to do now? Big speaker meeting up in Portland at the Longshoremen's Hall one night. And they're down there, the Al-Anon speaker done their thing, and it was during the break time or whatever, and somebody came up to me and said, Jim, there's a drunk in the meeting. I said, we can't have that. Show me where. And we go, we get to the crowd, and here's this woman over there with her arms just all over, having just a great animated conversation. He goes, that her? He goes, oh, that's her. Hang on, Augie, we're going in. And I got him with me, and man, we can't tolerate this crap in meetings, can we? I walked up and said, Mom, I want you to meet Bob. Just in his face, like, whoa. She loved the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I mean, some friends of mine, Harlan out of Seaside, and some other people were. I had to hand her over to you guys, you know, because it ain't easy trying to 12-step to family, is it? We're too close emotionally, physically, and all that kind of stuff, and I had to hand her over to Alcoholics Anonymous and to a power greater than myself. And that wasn't easy to do, but I did it, and I put her in the hands of some very competent and well thought of AA members. The bottom line is, she never figured out it was the first drink that got you drunk. She's never able to put that elemental fact together. And if you're new here, I got news for you. If you're an alcoholic, your drinking will never get better. It will always get worse. And to paraphrase the old man, and then it'll get worser. And then it'll get worser. Like I said, fourth grade education. And I understand that perfectly clear. You see, and Mom kept doing what she did. And me and my brothers, we've been watching my old man all these years. He's the one that's kind of exciting, like the rest of us. Mom was very quiet, sitting in the kitchen, just doing her thing, day in and day out. And also one day, there was a real problem with her. She was having some confusion, she was all disoriented. Dad took her to the hospital. Liver enzyme count is just pegged. They did some studies. Boom. Terminal.
alcoholic liver cirrhosis. And we ended up doing hospice. And in the process of doing that hospice, I was like, here I am now, I'm sober 6 years. And now it's time for the rubber to hit the road and really apply the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous in my own life with my own family. There's nothing that can be done for my mom. And she sobered up. She had to. One drink would have killed her. And her and I would sit there, and I'd sit down next to that bed with her. She had a copy of this book, which she'd read. She came to know a lot of you people and talked to a lot of you on the phone. And we sat and we talked about things in her family and relatives and some of the other stories behind the stories. You know, like Paul Harvey says, the rest of the story that I never heard. And that's where I believe that there's a real disposition in that side of the family, beyond question for me. And something happened. My old man wanted to do some work on the driveway, and he had some concrete guys on. There's no booze in the house. You know, and mom, there would be moments of lucidity, or days of lucidity, and when the liver toxins start bouncing around like that, some of you are familiar with it. The fog of alcohol, of late stage alcoholism. And what dad did with these concrete workers, it makes sense, doesn't it? He bought them a six pack. It was a hot day in October. And these guys, go figure, these guys are out working slamming concrete. They drank three of them. What the hell's with that? So there's three beers left over, and the old man put them in the refrigerator. The next morning, my mom, something happened, and health-wise, she just crashed. I mean, catastrophically. She'd be dead within 3 days. Just boom, there were two beers left in that refrigerator. Now, I suspect that what she did at night, because she was very thirsty because of the damage to her liver, is that she got up and she did what an alcoholic does. What the hell do you reach for? When you reach in the refrigerator and there's juice, or there's what? Maybe there's a Budweiser. This Bud's for you. Hallelujah. That's all it took. You know, and here we are the day that my mom died. Hospice, she's still in the bed. And the hospice people came over, and that's the most incredible program. It really is. And I honor the people who do that job. Because they carry a message of hope that is beyond my ability. And my mom was laying there in that bed. And family was coming through and saying their goodbyes and taking care of business, right? And the attendant came in to remove the body. And like in a bad book, all of a sudden this guy looked at me and says, can you help me? And I'm the sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Everybody looks to me about this program and different, you know, I'm it in the family. And I look at this guy and I said, excuse me. And I don't know if I said it out loud or whatever, but all of a sudden here I am over next to that bed and I'm sliding my hands underneath my mom. When I picked her up, you could still feel the warmth in the middle of her back. The body hadn't even completely cooled. And I'm standing there, I'm 6 years sober. I picked up my mother's corpse. She just died from the disease of alcoholism. And it's getting really real when you're in a place like this. I picked her up and I turned her around. And here was the stretcher they brought in. And he wants me to put her on the stretcher. And I lay her on the stretcher. And what he did, it looked like, I thought it was a sheet. And he picked up the sheet and he picked it up. He kind of folded it up and he zipped it up. On the outside were these pastel daisies. I just put my mother in a body bag. Just put my own mom in a body bag. And it's like, you know, you're just kind of rushing. You don't know if you should scream or just whatever. It's like, what in the... Jesus Christ. You know, and... excuse me for that. But it just was blowing my... It was shorting me out. And I'm standing there on the porch a few minutes later. They put her in the van and they're driving off with her. I'm standing there with my dad. And I'm able to be a son with my father, who even today, I was probably closer to Don Peeler than I was to my own dad. But at that day and that time, I was able to do the best I could. And from there, I went straight over and I hit the meeting over at the URS Club. Just walked in there and grabbed some of you guys that were hanging out and was able to sit down and talk with them, you know, and just hook up. You know, sobriety's a trip. You know, last night when I was sitting behind you guys for 33 years, you know, you, like you said, and I've heard it since day one, stay sober, don't die, you end up an old-timer. Hello, what a concept. You know, I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I love what you people have done for me. I love the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. The future is really kind of a blank slate, if you really think about it. The new people in the room tonight, if you think we're up here talking a bunch of flowery stuff or whatever, I'm no different than you. Anybody that shared here today, you're the speakers tomorrow. This isn't a big deal. I mean, tonight I'm it. Okay, then I'm going to sit down, I'm going to shut up and just become one of you, because that's what I am. I don't know. This program is beyond description for me. It really is. You've taken a stumble bum like me, and you brought me into your inner circles. You've taught me about a God I didn't understand. I've never been condemned. I haven't, you know, been overnight in a jail in 13 years. Overnight. Been in a lot of them for the day. That's a trip. You know, when you get to know the jailers, hey, Pete, how you doing? Hey, Jimmy, get out of here. But, you know, you take a stumble bum like me, and you put me into the winner's circle. And I'm going to close with this. It was good enough for Bill Wilson in his last talk, and by God, it's good enough for me, because it's all about you. I honor you, and I thank you for your lives. Good night.